Hello and welcome to Series 6 of Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics, brought to you for one series only from my flat. I'm not standing up, I don't know how to break this to you. I'm sitting on the floor. I'm sitting on the floor in a cupboard because that's the way we're recording this series. I'm sorry about that. It's just the way it had to be done. The other change we've made for this series is that we thought people needed to be transported away from the real world for a little while. So for one series only, I'm not doing historical figures from the ancient world, but mythological figures from the ancient world, women from Greek myth to be precise. And this episode is going to focus on the Amazons. So ladies and gentlemen, for this episode only, today I am standing up for, I say standing up for, today I am sitting down for Penthesilea, the Amazon warrior queen. According to the 5th century BCE historian Hellanicus of Lesbos, Amazons were a bunch of golden-shielded, silver-axed, man-loving, boy-killing women. I could kind of join that girl gang, maybe not the boy-killing. Amazons lived and fought as a tribe, and this is a really important point to differentiate them from male heroes, male warriors in epic poetry, for example. As we can see throughout the Iliad, the most famous example, men fight for themselves. They fight as individuals. When Achilles doesn't get what he wants in book one of the Iliad, he withdraws from battle, doesn't help his comrades, the men who till a moment ago were his comrades. Not only that, he prays to his mother, the goddess Thetis, to get Zeus to turn the tide of battle against them. It's all about individual glory. But Amazons are a gang. They are always a gang. They live in a place, or most usually they live in a place called Themyscira. Sometimes they're put in Libya, but usually it's Themyscira. And they're an incredibly popular subject for ancient authors and especially for ancient artists. They're routinely shown in groups. We have 1,000 Amazons painted onto vases and pots from the ancient world. They are the second most popular subject, mythological subject, after Heracles/Hercules. We have 60 names of them painted onto these vases too. So we know not only that there are lots of Amazons, that they're often in groups fighting, but also that we have names of loads of them. This is genuinely quite unusual with women on vase painting, so it's incredibly pleasing. I'm joined by Professor Edith Hall, ably assisted, technically speaking, by Richard Poynder. Edith, I wondered if you would talk to us a little bit, first of all, about real Amazons. Were there real women that inspired these incredible mythological fighting barbarian women, or are they just imagination?
I'm very glad to say that it's now quite clear that there were, for a very long time after Claude Lévi-Strauss's structuralism. Everybody said this is just an invention of the Greek imagination. They invented the idea of matriarchal tribes in order to somehow define their patriarchy, right? So we had about 30 years of this. They're just another construct of the Greek male imagination. And then wonderfully, high in the Altai Mountains, some burial grounds of nomads of the steppes were found, including one which was for a man and his wife, apparently. And the analysis of the skeleton of the woman, she was a high-status woman, showed quite clearly that not only was she in the saddle all the time, she had bow legs, and she had got ridges on her knuckles, on her right hand, that showed that she must have been doing archery all day, every day. How great is that? And there's been considerably more archaeological discoveries now. I mean, they're nomadic communities, they're pre-urban, exactly as Engels always said, that it was building cities and having property, real estate that you had to hand down. That was the point at which women went under.
And we've only been able to tell that skeletons were male or female quite recently, haven't we? This is a really quite recent shift in archaeology and DNA testing.
It is. But these first discoveries were coming through in the late 80s, early 90s. Mm. And I absolutely loved it because I was fed up with when you had got this really sort of strong, feisty heroine figure from antiquity being told that she was just another emanation of the male psyche, right? So this was wonderful. There certainly were women who had a hell of a lot more freedom galloping around what we now call the Russian steppes and Scythia, Ukraine, Georgia, all those sorts of places. And the Greeks will have heard about them.
And we have dozens of names of individual Amazons because they are painted onto, for example, vases where, you know, we get lots and lots of different individual Amazons and lots of names are painted on. Amazons have the most incredible names. Will you talk us through a few of them?
Well, we've got ones that are very clearly related to being a nomadic equestrian genius, like Hippolyta, the horse Lucer. Actually, Andromache is a very common one, because it actually means man-fighter, or she who fights like a man. But the one I like best is actually Penthesilea, because Penthesilea means the grief of the people, the people's lament. And of course, just as Hector dies at Troy and we end the version of the Iliad that we've got with the funeral of horse-taming Hector, the public funeral, the grief of the people, she's actually given that name. And she, of course, died at Troy. And, yes, you know, she's just as important to the people. She is worthy of the people's grief. So that's very gratifying as well. Even better, though, quite recently, we've discovered that on quite a lot of these vases where they're named, people said it was just Greek nonsense talk. There were sounds. They're written in the Greek alphabet.
Yes, but they weren't Greek words that we could identify.
So people said, oh, look, the vase painters had great fun just putting in barbarian speech, sort of thing an ancient Scythian or Amazon or Black Sea barbarian might have said. But no, these have recently been analysed by an expert in very ancient, prehistoric Black Sea languages like Circassian, right? Azerbaijani. And the beauty of it is that these names all mean things if you say those names as they're written out to an ancient Circassian. And they've got even better names. They've got one that's she who lets the dogs out. It's who let the dogs out? She let the dogs out. And it's on a vase.
But they're nomads. Where do the dogs get put in? I don't understand.
They go in their teepee. You let them out the teepee.
Okay, yeah.
They're
out
the fire with you at night. There's another one who's called Excellence at Archery. There's another one who's called She Who Lets Forth a Loud Trumpet Call.
I mean, these women sound like ones you want to hang out with. That's just true.
She Who Deserves a Large Costume of Armour. And She Who Is Enthusiastic About Sex.
Is she your favourite one, Edith?
Doesn't say who she has the sex with. You know, one of the issues never really explored. If they're not having sex with men, I mean, are they all lesbians? Really interesting.
So why did vase painters like Amazons so much? Well, firstly, they're exotic. They are not at all like the Athenian wives of the men who would be buying these vases, perhaps, in 5th century Athens or occasionally 6th century Athens. For a start, they wore leggings, trousers, which are an incredibly deviant garment for the ancient Greeks. Men would never wear such a thing, I assure you, and ideally nor would anyone. But also they're highly ornate. Their garments were incredibly decorated. If you look at any vase painting of an Amazon, she'll have geometric patterns maybe on her leggings. She'll be wearing an armoured tunic with sort of square patterns on. Those are little armoured patches of probably leather.
Well, they're kind of melded with the image of the Persian barbarian archer. They look very like Scythians and Persian men.
They sometimes have the same sort of hat.
Yep, they have their hats. Their accoutrements are made out of animals, little animal pelts, sort of little bunny rabbit caps and things. And they have the cutest little ankle boots.
They have such nice boots. I'm sorry to destroy all of feminism by the fact that two highly educated women are talking about shoes. I'm afraid it's just happened.
They're slightly pointy and they've got these little cuffs.
They're so cute.
That roll down and then they slide their lovely, as you say, variegated patterned leggings into these. I mean, it's a very cool look. And then they have lovely weapons of all kinds. Some are horsewomen, some are archers. We get absolutely gung-ho hoplites with enormous circular shields, just like Achilles. We get ones who've got slingshots, you know, full army of different kinds of combat gear. Horses and dogs are their real friends. They're almost always portrayed running around in the wild with their dogs and their horses, which is such a refreshing image after all these sequestered Athenian wives doing their weaving. And I feel in those vase paintings, there's a lot of affection for them.
Yes.
There's often a lot of humour.
The other thing that Amazons have are war belts. A war belt, the word in Greek is zerstra, and they are worn by men in the Iliad. It's the word used for war belts worn by Greek warriors in the Iliad. The word, sorry to keep going on about this, but I do get quite cross about it. The word for a woman's belt in Greek is zone. It's a different word. All right. And so when Heracles goes to claim Hippolyta's war belt, the word used in every source is zoster. It's a man-style war belt. And yet it's routinely translated as girdle, which sounds so twee. And I know it doesn't have to be gendered, but it still really is at this stage. So I would like you to bear in mind, although this programme isn't even about Hippolyta, that when Heracles goes to claim her girdle, he's actually going to claim her big badass leather war belt on which she keeps important war things. You are welcome. A strange addition to the myth of Amazon is that they cut off one breast to fight. People still ask me about this sometimes at live shows. It is the weirdest bit. I was completely baffled when this question first came up because I'd never come across it in the ancient world. If you look at vases from the ancient world, the Amazons, I promise you, are, you know, really symmetrical. They like almost always. And it turns out it's from a kind of phony folk etymology, which derives in Greek the word Amazon from the word a, prefix a, which is negating, and then the word mastos, which means breast, hence the word mastitis. So a mastos, without a breast. So they must have cut off one breast so they can more successfully use a bow and arrow. It's like, well, what? What? If you look at any picture of anyone, any woman, the goddess Artemis, for example, firing a bow and arrow, she almost always has it out at arm's length. You could have the most pneumatic, conical, Madonna-esque breasts and it would make no difference at all to how you could fire. But anyway, it's a loan word, the word Amazon. It's not a Greek word at all. I'm not sure, I don't think anyone is sure which language it comes from. But the Greeks absolutely love creating etymology for words that have no relevance to them at all. It's a sort of endearing intellectual hobby slash utter nonsense. But I promise you, Amazons generally, two breasts, not one, and perfectly able to fight. Born warriors. So much so that battles between Greek men and Amazon women were incredibly popular, both in art and in literature. They have their own name, an Amazonomachy, a battle against Amazons. They're always really closely fought as well. It's not an uneven fight ever. Pausanias, the geographer, travel writer, tells us of a scene at the Temple of Zeus at Olympia. A sculpted scene, I think. He very carefully counts the participants on each side of this Amazonomachy, and it's evenly matched. It's 29 Greeks versus 29 Amazons, so very fair. Amazons are the ultimate contrast, aren't they, to Greek male warriors? They're barbarian rather than Greek women, obviously, who fight, so they're not behaving in a way of respectable Greek women. They are dangerous, they're frightening, and yet they are also, I think, to Greek men, desirable. There's a reason why they keep painting them on the side of pots.
There's something about the unobtainable that becomes drives them absolutely crazy. So we have stories about two big love affairs, Penthesilea and Achilles. Achilles, you know, falls madly in love with the very Amazon that he's fighting, and particularly Hippolyta. And of course, this is immortalized in A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's such a fantastic story, and Shakespeare will have found that in Plutarch. There's a long description in Plutarch's Life of Theseus.
Yes.
The version I love most of all, though, is she did the partying for three whole days, and on the very last night, she told Theseus that she had to sleep alone on the night before the wedding, because that was somehow ritually correct. He couldn't come to see her at all until after they were married. And then all the Amazons had been secretly in ambush, and they freed her. They went into her chamber, escaped, and took her back to the Pontus forever.
And we definitely get the sense, don't we, that Theseus doesn't ever really forgive Hippolytus, at least in the Euripides play. And you can't help but think there's a part of him which is blaming Hippolytus for his mother.
He's brutal to Ariadne. He goes to Crete and he dumps her on an island, pregnant.
He's a terrible hero. He really is.
Terrible. And then he gets off with her little sister, Phaedra.
Again, terrible.
So he's just the world's worst husband lover.
He is. I think he is.
He's really, really shocking. There were also people so bothered about it. One of my favourite ancient traditions is that they were fake. They were actually just men who went around shaving and pretending to be women. I mean, that all sorts of speculation went on in antiquities from men who simply couldn't believe they really did exist. But as I said, we now know that they did.
Amazons aren't just warriors, although they are. They're also innovators in the art of war. Pliny the Elder tells us that Penthesilea, most famous of these Amazons, at least in the ancient world, I think maybe Hippolyta is more famous to us now, but Penthesilea invents the securim, a type of long-handled, sharp-pointed fighting axe. No wonder Homer can call Amazons Antianerae, equal to men. But let's look at one in particular in a bit more detail. Penthesilea, who invented that axe and fought alongside 12 Amazons at Troy. According to Plutarch, the Amazons were in no wise found wanting during the battles of Troy. Always enjoy a bit of litotes to make a point, you know me. Our best source for Penthesilea is sadly lost, other than fragments. The Aethiopis was an epic poem which followed on from the story of the Iliad. The last line of the Iliad, as I'm sure you'll remember from series 5, is, "And so the Trojans buried Hector, tamer of horses." But one scholiast, that's an ancient commentator, a writer on even more ancient authors, one scholiast had seen manuscripts. He's writing on Homer, and he's seen manuscripts with alternate versions of that final line, one of which reads, "And so the Trojans buried Hector, and then came an Amazon, the daughter of great-hearted Ares." Another version that he has actually names Penthesilea, "And then came graceful Penthesilea," I think, daughter of Atrera, who is her mother. Just to be clear, this is how male heroes are introduced to us in epic poetry. If they have a divine parent, that is always mentioned. It's so that we know that they're a hero. Penthesilea is not just the daughter of a god. She is the daughter of the god of war. No wonder she's a born warrior. Penthesilea comes to Troy to fight as an ally to Priam, king of Troy, and the rest of the Trojans. So she is fighting for a city which isn't hers. We're told by one source that the Trojans feel like drought-stricken land when rain comes, when the Amazons arrive. This is the very last part of the war, the 10th year of the war, after the Iliad, remember. So Hector, the Trojans' great defender, is dead. Penthesilea really is their last hope. She comes to fight the Greeks at Troy because she's atoning for having accidentally killed her sister, Hippolyta. She's trying to shoot a deer, I think, and she accidentally kills Hippolyta. She's so stricken with grief that she has to do something to atone for it. Even her name implies that grief was always bound up in her destiny. Penthos means grief. So Penthesilea comes to fight and really maybe to die. She wants to make up for the fact that she's done something horrendous, kill a relative. She thinks she'll be pursued by the Furies. This is again something which happens to men, of course. It's what happens to Orestes after he kills Clytemnestra. So just to reiterate, the things about her which are heroic in the most literal sense, i.e. like men who are heroes in epic poetry. She fights to defend a city, like Hector, who's now dead. She's descended from a god, like Sarpedon, son of Zeus, who's now dead. Sarpedon died at the hands of Patroclus in the Iliad. The writer Quintus Manaeus makes the comparison with Patroclus more obvious still. He calls Penthesilea nerpie, mad, for wanting to go and fight Achilles. That's the exact same word, nerpios, the masculine ending, used by Homer to describe Patroclus in Iliad, book 16. Penthesilea wants to fight Achilles, unlike, for example, Hector, who runs away from Achilles. She is desperate for this battle with the greatest warrior the world has ever known. She's not trying to run away. She's like lightning when the sun glints off her armour, which is divinely gifted to her. She and her women fight incredibly bravely. We're told that the Trojan soil turns red. They kill so many Greeks. But when it comes to the duel with Achilles, it is incredibly brief. You can see a famous and very beautiful version of this scene by the painting Ezekias on a vase which is held by the British Museum. It's a red background. Here's a black figure, and she is white. It's almost always the way on black figure vases that the men are painted black, but the women are white because they spend less time outdoors. In theory, Amazons, I guess, are an exception to that. He's still got his spears, so he hasn't really been inconvenienced by her. He kills her so quickly, but she dies at his hands. It doesn't make her less of a hero. Like virtually everyone else who ever fights him, he kills her incredibly quickly. He kills Hector incredibly quickly. The difference is that when he realises he's killed her, he is filled with sorrow. He never shows that kind of remorse when he kills anyone, I don't think, in the Iliad. But he's filled with sorrow for having killed Penthesilea. According to Quintus Manaeus, he feels as much love and grief as when Patroclus died. Let's just take a minute to think about what that might mean. I mean, he and Patroclus are so close in the Iliad that when Patroclus is killed in book 16... Achilles breaks his refusal to fight in order to take revenge for Patroclus's death, in order to kill Hector in revenge. And he feels this surge of emotion for this woman in the moment that he sees her as he kills her. That's the first time they've met. And it's perhaps no surprise that later authors couldn't resist turning this into a romance. Of course, even later ancient authors turn this into a romance. He sees her, she's beautiful, his heart breaks. In one version of the story, he falls in love with her in this moment of her death. And a man named Thersites, who is a sort of low-born man and therefore can't be trusted in Homer's worldview, laughs at him for the fact that he's fallen for this woman he's just killed. And Achilles reaches out and punches him and he drops down dead. That's how angry he is. Edith, Amazon stories in later sources often culminate with a love affair. I don't think we get so much sense of it earlier on, do we? Penthesilea doesn't start out in her story as being a sort of love match with Achilles. That gets written in later. It's almost as if we can tame these barbarian women if we suggest that, you know, they could just fall in love with a handsome man and then they'll be sort of like normal women and not like these barbarian fighting women.
Total male fantasy. Bonk them into shape, you know, bonk some sense into them. And then they'll actually happily settle for domesticity. There's some nicely balanced ones in Herodotus, though, where the Scythians and Amazons decide they can't actually live together, but they will meet and have sex and they will have joint children. So you have like a divorced couple who's meeting once a year to be very civilised and be nice to the children together, things like that.
Sometimes we get contradictory stories because names change. So Theseus sometimes marries an Amazon called Antiope, sometimes she's called Hippolyta, sometimes Hippolyta is linked with Heracles instead, sometimes with Theseus. But that's a sign, isn't it, that these characters were incredibly popular at the time that ancient stories are being created. That's why you end up with all those contradictory stories, because multiple bards across Greece at the same time are telling multiple different stories about them at once.
Unbelievably important. The other thing is that because the heroes of both the Trojan War and of the great Argonautic expedition had so many run-ins with Amazons, almost all the sort of Black Sea and Turkish cities of Greece where Greeks lived had a foundation myth involving an Amazon. And they would just grab any of these names. The one I like actually best is Sinope, which is all the way round east, northeastern Turkey, practically in Georgia, right? It's one of the easternmost Greek cities. And apparently that's named after a drunken Amazon.
Aha.
She actually got drunk with an Argonaut or something. They all have these stories that our local Amazons had some kind of thing with one of these Argonauts when they stopped off, or had some kind of a thing with Priam or whatever. You know, he talks about fighting them in the Iliad. And we've lost so many of those foundation stories. But every city in Anatolia could pretty much boast an ancestral Amazon. How cool is that?
The other really interesting thing is what happens to Penthesilea after she dies. There's another vase painting which shows Achilles carrying her body from the battlefield. There are almost no images of Greeks carrying fallen enemies from the battlefields. I think Amazons are the only people who they ever do this for. They often carry their own comrades, fallen comrades from the battlefield, but enemies, no. All the way through the Iliad, we see that the body of a fallen foe is something you can barter. You can sell it back, you can ransom it back to get something. That simply isn't what happens with Penthesilea. Achilles carries her from the battlefield. The other Greeks, Agamemnon included, agree to simply give her body back to the Trojans. The Trojans bury her with incredible honour next to their former king as one of the great defenders of their city. Remember what happens to the body of Hector? In the last couple of books of the Iliad, once Achilles has killed him, he drags his corpse around the city walls. He refuses to let anyone bury him for 10 days. It's only the intervention of the goddess Aphrodite that stops his body from rotting away. But Penthesilea is treated with total respect by everyone, except perhaps Thersites, who is immediately killed. If you're looking, by the way, for a comparison, Thersites is dumped in a shallow grave because nobody is prepared to run the risk of getting punched to death for burying him properly, just for the very mention of it. I wanted to tell the story of Penthesilea because I think it's really interesting that Amazons are presented to us by our ancient sources as such a sort of a strange and dual group. They are both masculine and feminine. They're clearly women, and yet they fight like men. They are non-Greek, and yet the Greeks seem really drawn to them. There are always battles with the Amazons, but the Greeks always initiate them. You know, Heracles goes to Themyscira to try and claim Hippolyta's war belt. Theseus abducts Antiope, which creates the second Amazonomachy at Athens, when, by the way, according to Aeschylus, the Amazons build all around the land around Athens in order to take control of the ground before they move into the city. They are good at war. Edith, they are serious fighters, aren't they? Penthesilea is an innovator. She invents the war axe, but they are proper serious fighters.
Oh, very much so. And you can see that in all the vases with all the weapons. Great stress is laid on the fact that they are the daughters of Ares. And funnily enough, one of the Circassian names I was talking about is the daughter of the very big man.
And like a mafia boss.
Like Ares, he's usually depicted as absolutely gigantic Olympian striding around being very, very big. So that's why the Areopagus in Athens, the rock of Ares, is called the rock of Ares, says Athena, because the Amazons built their camp there on this very, very jutty rock, which sort of challenges, almost rivals the Acropolis itself. So the Athenian men were holed up on the Acropolis, but the Amazons managed to get all the way into central Attica and actually occupy the other great rock. So that just gets over what a serious threat they were.
Digging up the Amazon stories, it takes some time, doesn't it? Because they've been lost. The Aethiopis, the great epic poem which told their story, only exists in fragments. People don't read Quintus Manaeus because he's quite an obscure source, although there's lots about Amazon. They're worth the effort, aren't they? We should put the time into hunting down these Amazons.
Oh, very much so. And now that we've also got anthropological insights coming in, we know far, far more about hunter-gatherers and nomadic culture than we did even 30 years ago. I mean, huge amounts of important archaeological information has come in, not just from the Altai Mountains, but from big sites in China. Half the world was dominated by people galloping around on these horses. We get a very one-sided picture just doing urban Mediterranean culture.
But what I think is most important about them and most strange about them, perhaps to ancient authors, and something that doesn't seem strange to us, so we maybe don't notice it now, is that they are always a gang. They are always a troop. And we started this with me telling you that what was important about Penthesilea was that she fought alongside her other women, that they're always this tribe. And I want us to end there too, to be honest with you. I think it's important enough to deserve both. When she goes out to fight to atone for the death of her sister, for which she feels such responsibility, she goes out with 12 Amazon warriors accompanying her, even when she has done something which she thinks so unforgivable that she should die. She still has women on her side. What better example could we have? Ladies and gentlemen, today I have been sitting down for Penthesilea, Amazon Warrior Queen. My guest was Professor Edith Hall, and my producer was the marvellous Ms. Mary Ward Lowry. I've been Natalie Haynes. Bye for now.